Okay, so I'm gonna just blow through the entire semester in a matter of minutes. Stop me. If something comes up and reminds you of something you want to ask about, just stop me and we'll deal with it and pick up the review after that. So the first lecture was an introduction. Mostly just said computers are everywhere, and they're doing more and more stuff. And I keep trying to hit on this point over and over again, that what makes computer science not the study of computers, which is probably what anyone would think hearing about the name. Actually, probably a lot of people would think it's the study of writing programs, but more generally, maybe computers. I think it's much more fundamental than that. I think really what we're doing is trying to understand how to map problems into simpler problems, making complex things out of simple parts, simple information parts. And I taught you how to read barcodes. In the second lecture, we talked about bits and switches. This is following along with the structure in the book. Bits are zeros and ones. They're really simple. Hard to imagine anything simpler than a zero or a one. But they can be used to represent anything by encoding things in sequences of zeros and ones. We started, and we've hit on this repeatedly over the course of the semester, how do you take an expression that has ands, ors, and nots, logical expressions in with bits or Boolean values, and figure out what they evaluate to. So we did a lot on that, and we actually had that on the midterm. I think I'm going to skip that on the final, though. People mastered that pretty well, so I don't feel like I needed to hit it any harder. There was a lecture on logic gates. Bits can be made out of... Oh, one of the parts of that was, how do you make a bit physically in the real world? And they can be made out of many things. I showed you a video where I marbles and Legos were used to represent bits and logic gates. I talked about dominoes. Oh, I don't know if anybody watches The Daily Show with Jon Stewart. At the end, the moment of Zen that he does at the end. I think just last week, there was a quick little blip of the new world record in domino toppling. They're now up to just over 4 million. And I was able to on YouTube, because, you know, YouTube doesn't care about intellectual property, I was able to find that video in its entirety. The Daily Show, they just showed a little snip of it. So we can now knock over slightly more dominoes than we could at the time that I gave this lecture. It's still not enough to build an entire Pentium, but we're getting it. All right, universal logic gates can simulate and or not, and therefore anything, any logical function. Gates can be defined in terms of simpler gates, which is an example of reduction. We talked about logical expressions with ands, ors, and nots, but also truth tables, where you summarize information about different combinations of Boolean inputs and what the Boolean output would be. And we've gone back and forth about taking a Boolean function, finding its truth table, taking a truth table, finding the corresponding Boolean function. We talked about one particularly useful thing to do with bits, which is to encode numbers, and the obvious number system to use is binary. We talked about some simple logic gates and recognizing some simple functions of logic gates. We talked about how you take a number and represent it in binary. We had a helpful demonstration from an octopus. We developed the skill of converting between binary and decimal, which at first seemed to stump a lot of people, but I think it was generally mastered by the group. Decimal here, by decimal I mean base 10. So our normal number system, going back and forth between that and just zeros and ones, binary. We also worked a bit on adding numbers in binary, including carries. So if you can actually get the right answer when numbers are expressed as bits. We've been building up. We had low-level bits. We talked about logical functions on those bits, more complicated functions that combine those functions, and we built all the way up to this idea of some fundamental circuits that would be enough to actually build a computer that can interpret general instructions. I really focused on just interpreting Boolean expressions again, like a machine language, but that's all it did because it was simpler to talk about. I talked a little bit about how you combine these things together to make a memory so that you can actually store lots of bits electronically and then retrieve the values and change the values, kind of like a scratch pad. The more bits that those things hold, the greater the memory. And of course, as you probably realize, the memory that's available on current computers has been growing quite a bit over the last 10 years. So this is how those things are made. Arithmetic circuits perform mathematics. Oh, so we talked a little bit about how you can actually take ands, ors, nots, and combinations of them to actually represent arithmetic functions, like adding two numbers together. In machine language, there's this notion of a clock cycle where at the beginning of each cycle, an instruction is fetched from memory, and then over the course of that cycle, that instruction is interpreted. It might write something to memory, it might change one of its register values. And then at the end of that, the whole thing gets repeated and it just gets run over and over again. So each cycle corresponds to one small instruction being executed. And the way we measure how fast a computer is how many cycles like that can it do every second? And now we're in the billions. So a billion times a second, it's cycling through this circuit and changing the values in the memory. And so that's where all the work is actually happening on a computer. Machine language programs themselves are made out of sequences of bits. So they are simultaneously changing bits, but they themselves are represented out of bits. So you have this sort of interesting little recursion that goes on. And everything the computer does is actually made out of these small instructions. So that's kind of the essence of how you build an entire computer out of these simple zeros and ones. All right, once we got up to machine language, then we kind of broke through from the hardware of how a computer does what it does up to the software. Now people can be programming it, building on top of what was presented earlier. This gives you the hierarchy, at least that's what Hill has called it in the book, the idea that you write application programs like, I don't know, a spreadsheet or a text editor or something, that's built on top of software libraries, which are built in terms of a high-level programming language like C++ or C# or Java or Python that we've used in our class. Those high-level languages are actually run by a series of machine language instructions on the actual hardware. Those machine language instructions are interpreted by logic blocks, which themselves are made out of some basic logic gates like ands, ors, and nots, or nans. And those gates themselves are actually physically implemented in something, which in the case of all computers that you would have access to, SAN, silicon. Silicon actually is the medium by which these bits are represented and transmitted, and so forth. Down to the transistors. So that's how, you know, that's how the computer does its thing. That's where the reduction is happening, all the way down from the lowest level of the silicon, all the way up to the highest level where you're actually running software, video games, or whatever it is that the computer is actually doing for you. There's all these steps in between, but they're all pretty simple. I introduced this notion of subroutines, this idea that one way to write a program is by encapsulating what are some of the functions that needs to perform, making them into subroutines, and then making them callable. And I made an analogy between these subroutines and in a song. If you want to represent a song, a chorus is kind of like this. You only have to write it once, but then later, if you need to return to the chorus, you just say, you know, go to chorus. If you have the right kinds of choruses, then the song can be represented compactly. If you make the right kind of subroutines, then a program can be represented compactly and simply and make it easy to maintain and reason about. I think on one of the homeworks I talked about, now it's your job to take a song and express it as a set of subroutines. I talked a little bit about changing what a subroutine does by allowing it to have parameters, where you can pass in some value, changes the way the thing behaves. And I introduced at least the notion of a subroutine stack to keep track of the program's place, so that each time it calls a subroutine, it has to remember where it left off. It's going to do this new function, finish that, and then it has to return to where it was. And so that's all kept track of on the subroutine stack. All right, now that we can write programs and algorithms and so forth, we can talk about algorithms, actually taking an idea of some problem that you want to solve in the real world and translating it into instructions on the computer. So the example that I talked about was sock matching, because that was the example from the book. But it let us talk about a lot of the simple but important functions that these subroutines seem to have. The point that I really wanted to drive home with this, that I hope you got, is that different approaches to solving a problem, different algorithms for the same problem, can actually be much better than others in terms of how fast they run. So by thinking a bit about which algorithm you really want to use to solve a particular problem, it can have a big impact on the size of the problem that you can really solve. And maybe that's not so important if you're sorting socks, but you can imagine situations where this is actually the difference between solving a problem that you care about and solving something that's just a toy version of it. Around then, let's see, we did some practice things on the homework, things like converting truth tables to logical expressions, converting and adding binary numbers, counting the number of gates in a multi-level logic block. That didn't go so well in the midterm, but that was something that we talked about. Okay, grinding through. Growth rates. So then I introduced this notion of big O notation and growth rates. Computer scientists analyze algorithms by their running time as a function of the size of the input. As you give it bigger and bigger problems, how presumably it gets slower. The algorithm gets slower, but how much slower? Does it get a lot slower or just a little slower? What we do is we name these different growth rates in terms of the functions that have that property. So you can talk about an exponential growth rate where each time you make it a little bit bigger, the running time can be multiplicatively more, like a double. Each time you make the problem one size bigger, it's twice as hard, or takes twice as long to solve. Or it can be linear. Each time you add one more element to the input that you're dealing with, the running time just increases by one unit. And then in between, we've got things like n log n and quadratic n squared. To try to get this point across to you, I presented it as an example of singing generalizations of songs where the song can have n verses, and the question is, how long does it take to sing a song from this class when it has n verses? And conveniently, the growth rate that we saw with songs, with common songs, mapped pretty well onto the common growth rates that we get in algorithms. So we had linear, and we had quadratic, and we had n log n, and we had n squared log n, which is not quite as common. And you can think about what it would mean for a song to grow exponentially. Though I don't think most songs do that because it would be sucky to sing such a thing. I also said that the number of syllables in detail is a pain to figure out as a function of n, but you can kind of approximate it with this big O notation, the asymptotic growth rate, which basically just says, don't worry about constants, don't worry about low-order terms. Just basically, is it linear-ish or is it quadratic-ish? It just becomes much easier to talk about and to think about and to analyze. All right. So I presented in detail some of these classes, these growth rate classes. So imagine if you've got a song with n verses, and each time you add a new verse, they're all about the same size. Then the growth rate ends up being linear. That is to say, the amount of syllables in the whole song grows proportionally to the number of verses. Whatever the verse size is times the number of verses. But that's only one kind of song. We also have some songs where each verse has a slightly larger number than the previous verse. And those don't grow very much faster than linear. But you can imagine if you've got a billion verses, at some point, the time that it takes just to sing the number is starting to dominate the time that it takes to sing the verse. And so you end up with a growth rate where you've got n verses, and the verses are getting longer, like the number of digits in the number, which is like log n. So you get an n times log n growth rate on those kinds of songs. Even worse than that are verses where songs where each verse is a constant size bigger than the previous verse. So you sing everything you sang in the previous verse, plus you add a little bit more. Things like, we had some examples of these, like the old lady who swallowed a fly. Right. Originally, she just swallows a fly, but then she swallows the fly and she died. I don't know. What was the other? What did you swallow after the fly? You swallowed a spider to catch the fly, but I don't know why she called it swallow the fly. She swallowed the frog. Is that what I heard?
Frog.
Is that what you said? Swallowed the frog to eat the spider. She swallowed the spider to catch the fly, but I don't know why she swallowed the fly. Next verse, we're going to say all that, but we're going to stick something that likes to eat frogs. You may have left me in a dead end direction.
Alligator.
She swallowed the alligator to catch the frog, to eat the frog. She swallowed the frog to eat the spider. She swallowed the spider to catch the fly. I don't know why she swallowed the fly. So each verse is actually a constant size bigger than the previous one. When you add up all those syllables that you have to sing over n verses, it's growing like n squared over 2. So we'll just call it n squared. Watch that. All right. And then you have these weird songs like the 12 Days of Christmas, which you may be hearing now. If not this, then a whole lot of songs like it, where each verse is actually a constant size bigger and has a bigger number in it. And so you have the n, because you have n verses, each verse has another factor of n in it, because each verse is getting longer because you're adding another day to it, and you have to say the digits in the number, so that you have an n times log n, or n squared log n. And so I'm not convinced that you get this yet. There's going to be questions like this on the final. But what I'd like, the skill that I'm hoping that you get before next Wednesday, is to be able to recognize the growth rate of a song. If I give you an example of the verses, to be able to figure out which of these classes it's actually in. There's the question. Go.
What's the difference between the quadratic and the quadratic logarithmic.
So in this one, you get stuff like the 12 days of Christmas,
right,
where so let's see. So verse one. So this would be an example of a really dumb song, but it would have the n squared log n growth rate. So first verse, you say the number one. The second verse, you count backwards from one. You go two, one. The third verse, you count backwards from three. Three, two, one. Okay. So each verse is getting a little longer. So that makes it look like an O of n squared kind of song.
Right.
For example, if the song was, the first verse is and the second verse is and the third verse is no one would buy that song. But the growth rate would be like n squared. But what's weird here is that instead of we're getting numbers, and these numbers are getting bigger. Now, you don't notice it until you get out to like 1,000 or 10,000 or so. But if you look at, you know, the millionth verse, I'm not going to write it all the way out, but it's going to go something like, you know, 1, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0. That's the first number. Then it's going to say 1, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 1. And then it's going to go 1, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 2. And you count all the way back. The verse, instead of just, right, this is actually, this takes log time to say. And so you get an extra factor of log n in the growth rate. So songs that have growing numbers, each verse is slightly bigger and has a number in it, and those numbers have to be growing, then you've got n squared log n. There's not a lot of songs like that, but there are some. I mean, 12 Days of Christmas has that property.
Wait, that zero thing you just described, what is that one? Quadratic or quadratic?
So this song, once you leave the grunting version of it, is that. It's n squared times log n. You get the n squared because it's n verses times each verse is like n size. Think about the last verse. It turns out that the last verse is always the one that basically dominates. So you're going to, it's almost like singing the last verse n times. The last verse in this case, you say n numbers, right? The nth verse, you're saying n numbers, and each number takes log n syllables to say. And so it's really n verses times each verse has n numbers, and each number takes log n time to say. That's n squared log n. So it kind of comes from someplace. Okay, all right. Distinguish proper growth. Oh, so yeah, so then I told you about my pet peeve of people in the press using exponential to mean a lot, which it doesn't, because exponential can be small. It's only big when you have a big number, an exponential of a big number. So I'll have some questions on the final where you basically, for each one, have to say, did they mean exponential meaning a lot, which is wrong, or do they mean exponential meaning literally as the parameter of interest grows, the other parameter of interest explodes exponentially? So it's usually time. They usually say things like the number of people playing Warcraft. Now, what's that one? World of Warcraft, thanks. The number of people playing World of Warcraft has been growing exponentially for the past, how long is it, around 3 years, maybe? Okay. So, in other words, if you plotted, if you made a plot of the number of, you know, time starting from 3 years ago, to now, and on this axis you have the number of people in World of Warcraft, that it's going to look something like this. In the beginning, there weren't a lot of people using it. Now there's a lot of people using it, and in fact, it looks like it's doubling. Each time some number of months pass, there's twice as many people as there was. And so you get these kind of scary plots, right, where it looks like it's going to go into the stratosphere forever. Now these typically, at some point, they have to flatten out because there's a finite number of people on our planet. But nevertheless, you see these exponential growth rates. And if somebody in a newspaper article described it as the number of people playing World of Warcraft has been growing exponentially, I'm cool with that. Because the plot actually looks like this. If they said something like, after they added this new feature, the number of people playing World of Warcraft jumped exponentially. It's like, it used to be here, and now it's here. That's not an exponential jump. That's two data points. It could be a line. Right? You don't know that it has this explosive growth rate. It has to be a trend. So I give my pet peeve to you. Enjoy it. Don't let it keep you up at night. All right, so the growth rate classes are also very useful for analyzing algorithms like the SOX sorter. So we talked about a couple different ways of sorting the SOX. It turned out one was more like Old MacDonald, and the other one was more like, you know, the dreidel song, in that the amount of work that you had to do each time was, get it was, you know, in this case, decreasing by a constant, then the total work ended up being a quadratic. So if you have to look through all n socks, actually, it's easier to explain in the case of sorting cards, right? You have to look through the whole deck to find the smallest one. That was n cards. You find it. Now the deck is a little bit smaller. You have to go looking again for the next smallest. Each time, it's taking a little bit less work than the previous card. But you have to do this n times, and so the total ends up being n plus n minus 1 plus n minus 2. It's basically n times n, or n times n over 2. So it's quadratic. Whereas if you just do, if reversing a list, you can do in linear time, because you know that the first element, you can just move it to the other side of the list. You can do that in constant time. You don't have to run through the whole list to know where this new one is going to go. So each element, each of the n elements takes, you know, one bit of work. So you get n times 1 or linear. So these things are not just good for songs. They're also really useful in understanding algorithms. I talked about compilers, this idea that people actually don't write programs in machine language because machine language is a drag. Instead, they like writing programs in languages that are closer to the way they're thinking about the problem. So something has to bridge the gap between the way that the programmer wants to express the solution and what the computer wants to see the solution as. And that's what compilers and interpreters do. They're programs that take programs in a high-level language and rewrite them as programs in a much simpler language. So they're like, you know, translators between, French and German or something like that. Though in one case, one's a much more simple language than the other. There are no good simple human languages. Are they complicated? You know, Klingon to English. I don't know, whatever. Okay, so that's what a compiler does. It translates programs into machine language that the computer can actually run. We talked a little bit about what a parser is, which is the first step is to take the program as it was typed in by the person and figure out what all the pieces are so that they can be translated into simpler things. Interpreters don't translate the program, they just run them themselves. And instead of worrying about all the details of all this, the example that I try to teach more directly is interpreting an expression tree. Expression trees are usually what come out of the parser. People don't usually type expression trees. But you type something, and then it gets internally turned into an expression tree. And that expression tree can be converted relatively straightforwardly into something that runs on the computer. So I wanted to get that idea across. We talked about graph algorithms. That one way of thinking about the web, for example, is you've got a bunch of nodes, and you've got links from node to node, which we draw as arrows, but you know, on a web page, they're the links. They say, if you're on this page and you click on this, here's the next web page you go to. And in fact, this graph is really important, because the only way Google knows what web pages are out there is by visiting the nodes in this graph. It actually hops from page to page to page. And so if you've got a web page and nobody points to it, as far as Google is concerned, it doesn't exist. Right? A web page is in the forest and it has no links. Does it make a sound? Yeah.
Cycle free, what does that mean?
So a graph is cycle free if it has no cycles.
Like if it doesn't go around?
Right, and a cycle means that you can follow the arrows from some node and end up back where you started.
Oh, you can't?
That is a cycle,
oh.
And it's something cycle-free if it doesn't have any of those.
Okay.
All right. So the same process by which Google goes out and indexes pages and finds pages to make available through the web search is also used to solve mazes. You can use the same idea to solve a maze. Both of those use solve a problem that could be called graph search, where you're at some node in the graph and you're traversing the links and you're trying to find connections between places you start and places you might try to go. Some of the keywords that came up when we were talking about graphs are nodes and links. Nodes are the circles and links are the arrows. Other terms, source. Source is a node that has no incoming links. Sync is a node that has no outgoing links. A path is a series of nodes that you can traverse such that each adjacent pair of nodes has an edge between them, or has a link between them. So basically a series of hops that you can take. A cycle is a path that comes back to itself at the end. Connecting components are groups of nodes where you can get from any one to any other one. And we can make graphs that have more than one connected component because there are places you just can't get to disconnect. Tor basically starts off at a node, it's a path, it visits all the other nodes, and generally ends up back where it started. A directed graph is one where there's arrows. An undirected graph is one where the arrows always, if there's an arrow from one place to another, there's a direct arrow coming back. And so sometimes we'll draw those without any arrowheads, right? Just for simplicity. If we have a graph where all the edges have the property that if there's a forward edge, there's a backward edge, we'll usually just draw it that way. And in fact, in the sample final that I made available, the graph didn't have any arrows. And what that means is, if you're here, you can jump to here. If you're here, you can jump to here. It's like arrows in both directions. Another way to think about this is a normal street. And when they've got arrowheads on them, then they're one-way streets. And so you'll see that on maps, right? They don't always say, the road goes this way and this way. They'll just, if they don't say it only goes one way, they mean it goes both ways. Okay? I think I told you about my recurring nightmare that the road system in New Jersey has sinks in it. And what that would mean is if a car ever got to that part of the graph, it would never be able to leave. And so slowly but surely, you'd be accreting this huge pile of cars. I'm pretty sure that's not a real thing, but I worry. A tree is a little hard to define, but it's easy to draw. A graph, usually it's drawn undirected. And it doesn't have any loopbacks in it. So it's a tree. I don't know what else to say about it. The thing is, the way that I just defined edges, there are cycles because you can go like this. If you draw it this way and you draw all the arrows going down, there's no cycles. But then, even so, then this will still have no cycles. But
If you have directed edges, then you can say there that each node has only one incoming edge.
Oh. Is that enough?
Yes.
Each node has only one incoming edge. You can draw it as a graph where all the nodes have one incoming edge. They can have lots of outgoing edges. They're only allowed to have one incoming, because that's the parent. Right, that makes the tree. Good. Okay. Yeah, so that there is some node which is its parent. I don't know. I didn't define it well. All right, moving on. We say that node X is reachable from node Y if there's a path from Y to X. Right, you're at Y. If you can get to X, it's reachable. Yeah, but you have to get there by a path. You can't just teleport yourself there. You have to follow edges that exist in the graph. But then we'll say it's reachable. That is on the final. I talked about sorting algorithms. The idea of sorting algorithm is motivated at least in part by just organizing your data so things are easier to find. If you have a bunch of things that have numbers associated with them, if you can put them in order, it's really easy to tell whether something's in the list or not because you can just see if there's two adjacent numbers and it should be between them, but it's not there, and it's not in the list. I talked about two kinds of sorts in detail, selection sort and quick sort. Selection sort is the one that I mentioned a few minutes ago that repeatedly finds and removes the smallest element from the list, which ends up giving it a running time of n squared. I demonstrated that with cards, but also in a song, because, then how could you not learn it if it's in a song? I talked a little bit about binary search, or this idea that you want to ask, if you want to minimize the number of questions that you have to ask before you find something, you want to find the question that splits things in half. And if something's a sorted list, it's easy to make up such a question because you just take the middle guy and you say, which side of that guy am I on? Am I on the left or the right? And then you can throw away the half that it's not in and focus on this one. When you do that, you end up just with log n questions. There's n things you're trying to get. If each question can throw away half the elements so you don't have to consider them anymore, you can only do that log n times. Each time, the list gets half as big as the previous one, and that's what log is. log of n is the number of times you can take n and divide it in half before you get down to 1. All right? I talked about quicksort as well, and I sang about quicksort as well, which is this idea that what you're, to sort a list, what you do is you just take one of the elements at random and split everybody up, depending on whether they're bigger or smaller than that element that you picked at random. That's called a pivot. So if things are smaller than the pivot, you put it on one side. If things are bigger than the pivot, you put it on the other side. And now you've got smaller lists to sort. You can sort each of those, and you know if you glue those sorted lists together, you'll have a sorted list, because all the small ones are on one side, all the big ones on the other. Because of that, because each time that you you compare a card, you compare a number to the pivot, it ends up in a much smaller list. Those lists can actually be half as big, and so that happens roughly log n times. Each card is going to be put into a smaller list about log n times, and therefore the total amount of time that it takes to do the sort is n log n. This is a lot smaller than n squared. And in fact, John demonstrated the program where he had, I demonstrated John's program, where there's a selection sort on a moderately sized list, not all that big list, just slow as molasses. But you run the same list through quicksort, and it's just sorted. And so, you know, click, wow, it's done. And so this scales really wonderfully up to huge, huge sets. And I'm pretty sure that Google is using something like that to sort through all their web pages to get them organized. If they were doing this, you know, they wouldn't exist. It would just be too slow. So one of the skills that we talked about at that stage is, you know, are you using the word exponential right? Given a generalized inverse sum, what's its syllable growth rate? Given a description of a sorting algorithm, how many comparisons does it make, or how many card flips do you have to do if you're sorting it in cards? I did a little diversion into computability. Basically, a lot of these ideas come from this one basic thought, which is, if you make some assumption, and by making that assumption, you get yourself into huge trouble, like a self-contradiction. You say, I think this might be true. Well, if this were true, then, you know, black and white would be the same color. Well, that can't be. So the thing that must be broken was the assumption. And so, in particular, if you assume that you can tell whether or not a program's going to loop forever automatically, that assumption leads to the ability to create a program that both loops forever and doesn't loop forever, which makes no sense. So the thing that's broken here is the assumption that we can solve the halting problem. So the halting problem can't be solved. I also talked about other examples of self-contradiction, like the Barber paradox, Gödel's theorem, and Cantor's diagonalization. This was just for flavor. I mean, I didn't ask any questions about this, and I don't know how much of it stuck. But it's just showing that this idea is actually much more general than the way we use it in computer science. So anyway, the upshot of all this is there are problems that you can specify that actually would be really useful to solve that are provably not solvable in general. You just can't write a computer program that does that. I talked about randomness, the value of actually doing things by choosing random numbers. Quicksort has an element of this because it chooses a random card to use as the pivot. But doing surveys also has this sort of property that if you want to find the average of a really big set of numbers, the one way to do that is by just choosing a random subset of them and computing the average of that. If the subset is sufficiently big, it will be a very good estimate of the average of the whole set of numbers, the whole population. To make random numbers, we can get things that, you know, look almost are indistinguishable from random using complex multiple numerical mixing up functions, which I don't think I talked about in detail, but he mentions it in the book. And one of the things you can do with these random numbers, if you've got them, is you can use them to send random codes by taking the message that you want to do and kind of corrupting it using these random bits. As long as you and I share the same random bits, we can uncorrupt the message the same way. And so this is useful for sending messages that can't be cracked. The skill, so this, you know, a bunch of sort of random facts, but the skill that I was hoping you'd take away from this is to, given these really, really small little subroutines I've been showing you, tell me, does this halt on all inputs? And it's just, can you look closely enough at the program to be able to figure that out? I told you about parallel computation. The motivation here was that Moore's law, which has been holding pretty steady for a while now, says that computers double in speed about every year and a half. Every 18 months, the computers that are available are about twice as fast as the computers that were available 18 months ago, which is pretty remarkable, and you get an exponential growth rate in the speed of computers that way. But nevertheless, we are getting close. You know, within our lifetimes, we're going to hit the limit of that, and we won't be able to make computers any faster by making the cycle time any faster. So instead, we can maybe speed them up by having multiple computers working on the same problem at the same time, solving different pieces of it. And the upshot of all this was some problems can be sped up that way, and some can't. And it seems to come down to whether or not separate parts of the problem can be treated or dealt with simultaneously without having to communicate back and forth every step. There are some other problems that seem like they shouldn't be able to be parallelized, but they are, but you have to be pretty clever about it. Hillis gives a nice example in the book about that. Partly, he's very interested in these kinds of issues because he made a computer with 65,000 processors, and he had to go around selling it to people. It was $2 million. And the only way he could do that, people would say, but you can't do that, he would say, here's an example where we can speed things up. So he gathered up quite a large set just for sales reasons. But they're interesting algorithmic problems as well. I talked about compression, this idea that if you're trying to represent some information, like a series of characters, say the Gettysburg Address, or a photograph, or a song, you have to somehow represent that in terms of bits. And there's different ways to do that. And some end up needing more bits than others. This idea of compression is to try to take an encoding of a message that might be long and turning it into something that's shorter, either by throwing away unimportant bits or by just being much more careful about how the bits that you've got are actually used. We talked in a lot of detail about Huffman encoding in particular, and what it does, it actually gives you the optimal code for individual characters, assuming that the thing you're trying to encode, the number of times you see each letter is similar to what you had. Let's just say it another way. If you've got a long message and you want to encode it, and you have to encode it by encoding each individual letter with a code, then what the Huffman encoding does is it takes advantage of the fact that common characters, if you give them short codes, you get a much smaller message size, a sequence of bits, than if you don't do that. So it finds the best way of doing that. And in fact, we now all know how to take a string and build a Huffman code for it, and also encode and decode strings, go back and forth out of that. So we talked about that in detail. I mentioned neural networks and machine learning more generally. In particular, NeuralNet is an example of a classifier learner that learns to map feature vectors to just yeses and nos, to bits, essentially. That we can create these classifiers automatically, we can learn them, by taking an example training set and finding something that works well in the training set and hope that that training set was representative of how you're actually going to use it. If it is, then you can generalize, and actually the classifier that you learn will work well on new examples. And we actually did a demonstration in class where we collected data, I collected data from everybody, and then we built a decision tree that classified everybody as being male or female, and it worked perfectly. It didn't generalize well to my family, though. So it really matters that the collection of individuals that you're classifying and that you have training data for, they need to be really closely related. All right, that was decision trees, but we talked about decision trees can be constructed from examples applied to new instances in the demo. Perceptrons is another way of doing classifiers, and it uses linear threshold functions. It takes the features, and if they're all numbers, it multiplies each of those by some weight value, and then adds them up and sees whether that total is greater or less than a threshold. And if it is, then it answers yes, and if not, then it answers no. But there's nice ways of actually learning those weights from experience. They can only solve linearly separable problems, problems that you can split the yeses from the nos with a line. High-dimensional line, maybe, but still, it has to be a line. And was this the last topic? No, not quite the last topic. So then the last chapter of the book dealt with genetic algorithms. This is the idea of a search algorithm that is made with an analogy to the biological world. So it uses a population to find good solutions. These populations of individuals, often bit strings, but they can be trees and programs, and they get to mate if their fitness is sufficiently high, and we hope that they then produce generations of improved individuals, and if you just repeat this, you're going to get better and better answers to the problem. It doesn't always work, but it tends to be, as I said, maybe the second best way of solving any problem. We didn't actually talk about this, but it's an easy enough thing to do, but it's not on the final, so I guess I don't need to say much more about it. But one of the things that made this topic really fun to have at the very end of the book is it ended up drawing in an interesting way on a lot of concepts that were that came up earlier in the semester, like sorting and randomness and comparisons and subroutines and bits. They all had a place in here. So it was kind of the pinnacle of evolution. No, it was the pinnacle of the reduction idea that we've been talking about. And the last lecture, before this one, was on robotics. And I tried to motivate that by saying this notion of a while true loop, a loop that basically never ends, is actually really useful if you're trying to construct programs that have to continue to do the right thing for an unbounded amount of time. They're not just asked a question and they give an answer, but they have to just run and continue to behave properly. So I showed some robot examples. I told you a little bit about robots. I said robots are really just computers. So we could call this robot science if we wanted, but computer science sounds better. And I talk also about some of the things that we're doing in my own personal lab, which is about robots and solving other kinds of problems by learning. I talked about reinforcement learning, defining a task by, you specify a reward function, what it is you want it to have accomplished, or the goal that it should have, and then the program changes its behavior to try to make that work. Kind of put the onus of the real programming on the robot itself. We just tell it, you know, good robot, bad robot, and hope that it can work out the details. All right, so that was the run-through. The final is next Wednesday. It'll be in this room, and it is open book, as I said. What I'd like to do now is open up to more questions. One thing I could do is bring up the sample final. I don't want to give the answers to the sample final because I want you to use that as a way of checking yourself to make sure you really understand. But maybe we can make up similar questions, or maybe you've seen it and you can ask me similar questions. So let me open it up.
Yeah. What do you mean on the sample final when you say hammering the code? Is that the tree that we were...
Oh, I messed up again. So I keep getting Hoffman codes and Hamming codes mixed up. So the title was Hamming It Up. It was meant to be a pun on the wrong word.
I didn't understand.
But yeah, so you want to know you want to do one of those problems.
Well, what do you mean when you...
Okay, yeah, let's do one of those problems. Let's just do...
What? Yeah, but
So one question that I got from someone in the class, but other people might be confused about it, is these trees, there's more than one right answer for these trees. They're not unique. But here's the interesting thing, and this is probably how Huffman did his proof. All the different trees that you can get, if there's ties, you can have decisions you can make, you can make one branch zero, or you can make the other branch zero. There's all these choices that you have, but they all are going to lead you to represent the final message with the same number of bits. They all will compress the message exactly the same amount. And so that's, on the final, that's what I'll look for. I'm going to look to see how long your string is, because the details of it, each of us could actually create a different tree and they could all be right. But they should all encode to the same length at the end.
Say on the final you give us like an uneven number of letters, you know?
Like six and a half?
Seven. Not an even number.
Okay.
Even say five.
Okay.
You would take like two and make a little tree.
Uh-huh.
Another two and make a tree. Uh-huh. And then
not necessarily another two. It could be one of the first ones. But anyway, yes.
Maybe we should just do
one. Let's do one. All right, so give me a word that has repeated letters. Or just tell me, so we can just do it really abstractly.
Even a five-letter word would be cool.
Well, a five-letter word or five different letters? All right, so here's the five letters, A through E. Reminds me of the clickers. And how many of each of these do we have? How many A's?
Just make four.
Four A's.
Three.
Three B's.
Five.
Five C's?
Six.
Six D's?
And two.
And an E. Okay, two E's.
Yeah.
All right. So that's fine. So you would get this, for example, if I had a message that looked like,
I thought you were going to come up with that.
I know. I was going to go there. I think I'm missing a C. One, two, three, four, five. Okay, so if I said, find the Huffman code, not the Hermann code, find the Huffman code for this, for the characters in this sequence. This is what you do. First step, figure out what the unique letters are. There are just A through E, so I wrote them down. Then count up how many each letter you've got. So one, two, two B's, or not two B's. Yeah, sorry. Come on. All right. So three B's. How many A's? One, two, three.
You missed one.
Four. Okay. How many C's? One, two, three, four, five. How many D's? One, two, three, four, five, six. I put them all together. And how many E's? Two, one, two. All right. So now we're here. Now this sort of matters a bit less. Okay. So now what do? Now we sort them by frequency. So in other words, we put the ones that occurred the most times at the top. So there's six D's. Well, we don't even have to do it that way. We can just say, take the two smallest. The two smallest at the moment are E and B. And we're going to merge them together in a tree.
Start low
on the chalkboard. I made that mistake before. Thank you. E. This isn't going to be too big, though. There are two E's, and there are three B's. And now we've got a new subtree of size 5. So, I don't know. Let's just call this...
Call it EB.
Don't you put the 5 in there?
Yeah, that's a good idea.
The
pardon me?
Don't you put the 5 on the inside so that you put the old one?
Yeah, that's a good idea. All right. And so now, we don't really have to worry about B anymore, and we don't have to worry about E anymore, but we have something new to worry about, which is EB, which has a count of 5. This is the part where why it doesn't matter whether it's odd or even. Because we took two things, we merged them together and made one. So we now have, whereas we used to have 5, now we have 4 things to worry about. That was a bug in your mental algorithm about how this was supposed to work.
All right.
But this is what you want. You now have to consider where EB is going to fit with these other guys. Okay? Now we still want to take the two small, this is not quite how I drew it before, but this is John's idea just now, and I think I like it a lot. So we now need to figure out the two smallest of what's left. Okay, so we could do, so A is one of them, and I don't know, could be EB, could be C. It turns out it's not going to matter.
We'll do C.
We'll do C. All right, go ahead. You're with me. All right, so that's going to give us another tree with A with a count of 4 and C with a count of 5. They get merged together. And now A is going to go away and C is going to go away, but AC is going to come with a count of 9. Okay? So now we're going to repeat this process again. What's the smallest now? We've got D and EB are 5 and 6. AC is 9. So we're going to need to add to this tree here. We have D with a size of 6. We're going to merge these guys together. Size of 11. Okay? So DEB has a size of 11. There's only two things left, so we'll have to merge them. So we will. Size of 20, 0, 1. All right. So.
Wait.
Okay, I can do that.
Hold on.
Does anybody have the sample final? What question did I ask you after that? Like, take the original thing and put this code to it?
Unfortunately, you erased the original.
Yeah, but the original method was hideous anyway. But let me at least do this.
You got it. I didn't understand.
So A has the code 10. B has the code 011. C has the code 11. D has the code 00. And E has the code 010. Okay? So it came up with a variable length code. Some of them have length 2, some have length 3. And you'll notice that the ones that got the smaller lengths are the ones that are the longer, the more frequent characters. Like D, there were 6 of them. A, there was 4 of them. They end up being the small ones. So now we can see, if we wanted to encode the word, cab, we just put the code for C, followed by the code for A, followed by the code for B, and that's cab. All right, how many bits are in that? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. And what's neat about these Huffman codes is that if you started from a string and then you go and encode that string, even if we had broken these ties or changed which ones are the zeros and which ones are the ones, the total length of bits, the total number of bits it's going to take to encode that message will be the same. It'll be the minimum possible.
For baby, how is it 0 and 1? Isn't it 1 on the outside?
Oh, you know what? It is. You're right. But I circled it and it looked like a 0 to me.
Oh, so it's 1 1 0?
No, it's B is 0, 1, 1.
Oh,
no, it is. It is that. Sorry, that is what I wrote. So answer your question again.
I thought like you go from the bottom, like 1, 1.
No, you have to do it from the top.
For all of them?
Yeah. Yes.
Okay.
So, for, you know, like you might be confused because D,
yeah,
it looks the same. But really, you're doing it from the top because it's telling you where to go. It's like directions. Start at the top, now where do I go next?
Okay.
Right, and that makes it easy to decode. Because if I did the codes from the bottom up, and I told you, you know, 1, 0, you wouldn't know where to go, because you could be starting here or here, and it's confusing. As much as it's just clean going top down.
Yeah, but for the question, the review, you say count the frequency.
Yeah.
I mean, you count the numbers, like...
How many, frequency means how many of them are there. So, how many A's are there?
Okay.
That's the frequency of A. Okay. It's not like... There's other meanings of frequency, but that's what I mean.
And then it says, what's the whatever code?
And then the code, if I ask for the code, how did I phrase it?
What's the hammering code?
The Huffman code. So the Huffman code would be, what bit pattern do you get for A? What bit pattern do you get for B? What bit pattern do you get for C? Oh yeah, and I think the last question, I think I was smart enough to realize that the last question should be now, how long in bits is the original message, the yabba dabba doo, or in this case, the back, whatever it was. How many bits does it take to write that down using this code? And what's cool is different people are going to get different codes, but everyone's going to get the same length, assuming that it's right.
Like how you just did it for
CAM,
you mean? Like?
No, it has to be the original message. You could end up with different lengths for words that weren't the original message.
Well, right. Well, if CAB is original.
If CAB were the original message, then you'd end up with, yeah, that's right.
Okay.
And so what you get in CAB, two of them would be 2-bit codes and one would be a 1-bit code. And it doesn't matter which one you make the 1-bit code, you still get 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 bits altogether. So that's an example. We could do that proof, but I don't think anybody wants to see it. Okay, all right, good, okay, we're back.
Can you do an example of that demo thingy, emotion?
The what?
Help me again.
I have a favorite with you, I turned it off. What's it called? Where you have to like take something in the front and then move it to the back and all that.
Oh, the promotion sort?
Yeah.
I could do that for the homework, but it's not on the final.
Oh, no.
Oh, okay. Then why did you ask us on the homework? Because, you know, I wanted to ask slightly more than I was going to test you on. Yeah?
Why do you know
the question? I mean, the homework answer?
Oh.
I'm waiting on Monica. Monica, she'll get the job done. She always does. We handed back, like, 1, 2, and 3, but there's, like, 4, 5, and 6 still to come back in terms of the example answers. Yeah? And we should also make example answers for the example final, because knowing what's on the final is helpful, but knowing the answers to those questions, that's a bit more helpful. All right, so where are we in time now? Are we getting close to the end? Oh, yeah, it's very close to the end. All right, so if you'll indulge me one last time, I'm going to summarize the class in a song, because, you know, actually, mostly you, because you asked last time, you said, oh, I You seem like you like them, or at least you don't mind listening to them as much as you mind listening to me. Other questions, please email. We can set up time to talk. We've got a whole week from now until you got to know this stuff. And anything seems unclear that's on the final, you'll know it's there. You can ask about it. It shouldn't be so bad. All right. So here we're going to go. Meanwhile, what am I doing wrong here? Okay. All right. All right, that's probably good volume. So I sang the song, I recorded the song, but I didn't make a video. I made a slideshow, so I have to advance it. So here we go.
Charles Babbage's machine has spread to everywhere it seems. They process data and communicate, entertain and even educate. And the vision of an automatic brain is retained within computer science. There's just the lowly bit, and ands and ors and nots, that's it. But from the relay of a logic gate, high-level languages can emanate, and each function's built on the base that is underneath, just out of reach. And that's computer science. XOR, to count to 90, maybe more. Programs learning without faulting, programs running without halting. People singing songs with verses that extend to N log N. Is that computer science? Some programs learn to play great chess, or shrink the Gettysburg Address. Sorters ordering a stack of cards, robots scouring for life on Mars. And you need like half a billion bits for storing just an hour of silence. And so it's really made the grade, this little counting box we made. And though machines get all of the glory, this is really not just their story. Spare a thought to the bright men and women who struggled hard to generate and thus create great insights. See,
thanks for everything, you guys. I will see you in a week. Please, the communication panels are open, so if you've got any questions, let us know. And good luck to the other finals as well.